Gary and I have become great friends, in part because we were both huge wrestling fans. So I knew if there was anyone who would back me and try to get this done, it was him. We could put on a wrestling event, I said. Raise money that way. As the others in our group scoffed and faded off to continue talking about more traditional fundraising efforts, Jerry and I were becoming even more adamant that we had something, a great idea. We just had to figure out how two kids with no contacts in the business were going to put on a wrestling card with named talent from television. We had heard the stories about how hard it was to get inside, that wrestling was a closed shop, a mysterious business. What stroke of genius could we come up with to break into the clandestine inner circle? The wrestling business was notoriously hard to get into unless you had a family member already inside, or you are a star athlete. Both Jerry and I had no family in the business, and we certainly weren't star athletes. Think we could just phone them? Jerry asked. Okay, I replied. So we phoned them. We were all shocked. The call worked. We were invited to the Monday night event in the Tulsa Assembly Center to meet Leroy and his behemoth partner, known to his family as William F. Watts Jr., but as Cowboy Bill Watts to wrestling fans across the country. I didn't even know that Leroy was an owner. The plan was we were to come down to discuss what we had in mind. But before we could talk business, the Cowboy had a little business of his own he needed to attend to, an NWA World Heavyweight title match against the Toughest Nails Harley Race. And we were comped ringside seats. I watched from the edge of my seat as the referee was inadvertently knocked out. Bill and Harley took bumps to the outside of the ring on opposite sides of a corner ring post. Harley managed to get to his feet first, and seeing the referee was still unconscious, he grabbed Watts and ran Watts' head into the steel post. As Race gloated, the referee finally came to and slowly made it back to his feet to begin the count. If Watts didn't make it back into the ring before the count of 10, he would lose. One, shouted the still groggy ref. No sign of the Cowboy making it back to his feet. As the ref continued to up the number scale, the crowd went nuts. There was no way the dastardly Race could come into Watts' backyard and win by cheating. Eight. Men, women, and children roared Watts' name, willing him to rise up and make it back inside the ring before. Nine. And from the far side of the ring, a defiant hand rose up. Then the top of a bloody skull. Watts' eyes were distant, rolling in his head. His face was covered in his own free-flowing blood. He was badly hurt, but not out of the fight. Just before the ref could finish calling the last number, Watts threw himself on the bottom rope and just made the count. I was hoarse. Jerry was hoarse. Watts was in no fit shape to continue, but that didn't stop him from trying to find his feet. The referee approached him and immediately wanted to stop the match due to Watts' blood loss. The Cowboy, barely conscious, face completely covered in blood, was insisting the match should continue. The official waved off the Cowboy's pleas and called for the bell out of concern that Watts was unable to defend himself. The official call was a stoppage due to excessive blood loss by the challenger. I would have been as angry as the rest of the crowd if I didn't know that myself and Jerry were about to have a private audience with the valiant challenger and his partner. It was showtime. Jerry and I lingered near our seats for a while as the crowd filtered out of the arena. I ran over my pitch and tried to put in order all the thoughts I wanted to verbalize. After the building was emptied, Jerry and I tentatively headed back up to the lobby of the arena, where we'd been told the office door was located. I timidly knocked on the door, and to my surprise, Bill answered. I don't know why I was surprised. After all, I was there to meet him. He had had a chance to grab a quick shower, but his head was wrapped in gauze, tape, and bandages right above his eye. He was still sweating as we entered the smoky office. Leroy McGurk sat in a chair, puffing on his cigar, with the walls around him covered in pictures of him with the Hollywood elite of the day from his time in wrestling in the Hollywood territory. Up close, Watts was even bigger. It was kind of surreal to finally meet in person two people who I had watched for so long on television. "Well, I heard you had a rough night out there tonight," Leroy said to Watts. Bill answered as he sat down behind his big oak desk. "Yeah, Leroy, he got me on that ring post, and it's a pretty good gash. I lost a lot of blood, and the referee was worried about me and stopped it." Leroy shoved a cigar in his mouth. "Well, I know that's got to be disappointing for you, but it's better to be safe than sorry. Don't worry, you'll get another shot at it." Leroy and Watts were putting on a masterful performance for an audience of two, and both Jerry and I were eating it up like it was vanilla ice cream with that beloved Hershey's chocolate syrup on top. I kind of thought this was my first experience of kayfabe, which I'd heard was an old wrestling behavior that was designed to keep the secrets of wrestling away from the paying customer. "What's your marketing plan?" Watts asked. Jerry bumped my leg as that was my cue. Watts nodded for me to begin, so I cut to the chase. "I can get us radio airtime for free," I said. "And how are you going to do that?" "We're making this a public service announcement," I replied. Watts smiled. He looked at Jerry to see if I was serious. Jerry nodded in affirmation. I knew I had their attention, so I quickly continued. "Our fraternity is non-profit. We can get the on-air time." Watts leaned in. "I won't stand for any of my wrestlers getting stabbed, so you provide security. And I also don't want any fights before the show, so we're going to need two separate dressing rooms to keep some of our wrestlers apart." Leroy chimed in. "Two dressing rooms are no deal." Watts continued. "We'll provide the card. That's eight men and a referee. And I'm not going to say who those men will be, but you'll get a good card. And we'll mention the event on our local TV show." I tried to cut in. Watts wasn't done. "On top of the security, you provide the venue, the ring, and an announcer, and sell the tickets." I was trying to get in and simply say, "Okay, sir," but he still wasn't done yet. A red dot of blood was beginning to seep through Watts' white bandage, though he didn't notice. "You can keep the concession money for soft drinks and popcorn, and we get 80% of the gate, and you get 20%. Plus, the first $250 comes off for us to pay for the ring usage and transport. Deal?" he said. I could hardly wait to reply. "Deal," I said. And with a handshake across a big oak desk, my journey into wrestling was about to begin. But first, there was a slightly awkward pause before Watts nodded at the door to let us know it was time to go. As I walked with Jerry into the empty parking lot outside, I realized that we had to pay $250 to the guy who supplied the ring and drove the truck. Of course, that guy was their employee. It was their truck and their ring. "I know people say wrestling is fake," Jerry said, "but did you see his head? Maybe some of it isn't on the up and up, but those title matches are legit," I replied. Chapter 7, The Fundraiser, 1974. We didn't get Bill on our card for our fundraiser, but we did get the legendary Danny Hodge. Bill was smart. He didn't know how well we would do, but if the show died a natural death, well, must have been Hodge's fault. As far as I was concerned, this was about the best news we could have gotten. We had Danny Hodge. People use the term living legend a bit too freely for my taste, but that term perfectly described Danny Hodge. He was a collegiate wrestler from the University of Oklahoma, where he was undefeated in 46 matches and never taken down. He was also a three-time Big Seven conference champion and won the NCAA championship those same 3 years. On top of his wrestling credentials, he was also a Golden Gloves boxer as a heavyweight, finishing his amateur career with 17 wins, no losses, and 12 knockouts, all with no formal training. And as great a competitor as he was, Hodge also did not disappoint as a gate attraction when he moved into professional wrestling. Our show sold out the school's basketball arena, which seated about 2,500 people. And it was probably one of the safest sporting events in school history because it seemed like a third of Oklahoma's law enforcement community was in attendance. We had state police there, plus the Cherokee County Sheriff's Department, the City of Tahlequah Police, and members of our Northeastern State University Police Department. I'm sure that everyone in attendance safety was a top concern, and that the long vid we're getting to see a free wrestling show headlined by Danny Hodge was just a happy byproduct. Regardless of the officers' reasons for being there, I knew McGurk and Watts would both be impressed that the show had such a strong, uniform presence. One of the main reasons for the large crowd was the pre-show publicity we were able to obtain leading up to the event. I wrote the copy for the advertisements, voiced over the spots, and then delivered the recordings to every radio station within a 60-mile radius of Tahlequah. Several months later, we co-promoted a second fundraiser with the wrestling promotion. This time, Bill booked himself in the main event. We sold out again. Before the show started, Cowboy had one burning question for me. "I don't understand this. How are you making this work?" he asked. I told him about the radio spots, among other things, which I had also prepared and distributed for this second show. And he said, "Well, I've got to get ready for my match, but let's talk when the show's over." It was a different kind of main event because at our first show, Hodge had put in about 30 minutes of mostly chain wrestling and technical battles of holds. Watts' main event lasted only about 10 minutes, but it was a high-impact affair with a big cowboy putting his tremendous strength on display with his arsenal of power moves. And no one felt cheated because both shows clocked in at just over 2 hours. Heavyweights didn't need to go that long, except for special occasions, Watts said to me after the match. We found a place to talk, and I went into more detail as to how we had promoted the event. I talked about radio, as well as how I peppered the town with posters and got the newspapers to use publicity shots with enhanced captions for the event information. He was also impressed with our handling of the event itself. We did a lot of things that just seemed to be common sense, but which the regular local promoters weren't doing. And the radio promotion was something that Bill and Leroy weren't even doing in Tulsa, which was their flagship city. Bill later told me how that Oklahoma promotion ended up being the first to use radio spots, because not even the promotions in the media capitals of America were doing that. Cowboy was impressed enough with my efforts and ideas that he said to me, "I'll tell you what, kid, you got something going for you, and you got a feel for promoting wrestling. When you get out of here, if you decide you want a job, I'll have one waiting for you." At that point, I was close to graduating. All I had left was one semester of courses and a second semester as a student teacher, and I was done. Instead, I left school. In a lot of ways, getting into the wrestling business was a crazy decision. I knew I was starting a job without even knowing exactly where I'd be working, to whom I'd be reporting, how long the job would last, or even what the job entailed. One of the only things I did know about my new career was that there was no benefits, no health coverage, no dental, no retirement plan. I was going to make $125 a week as an independent contractor. Wrestling was one of my passions, and the way I saw it, if it didn't work out, I could always go back to school, finish my degree, and make a living teaching and coaching. However, the reverse might not be true. If I passed on this offer, there might never be another chance for me to enter this very closed-off business. I was married, and we had very little money. We lived in a very Spartan, small, rented house, literally surviving paycheck to paycheck. And even though I juggled coursework with three jobs, making ends meet never got easier. I figured I'd try my hand in the wrestling business for a while, and then be back at school, possibly as early as the following fall. I was 22 years old. Chapter 8, Start in the Business, 1974. "Hey, kid, is my wife still a fat bastard?" Hell of a question to ask a 22-year-old kid fresh off the farm, especially when the heartbroken wife in question had just walked into the room unannounced and heard the query. Leroy McGurk was looking straight into his wife's direction, but couldn't see her. This answered any doubts I had as to whether the man I saw on my TV wearing the dark glasses was, in fact, blind. I said, "God damn it, is my wife still a fat bastard or not?" I sheepishly looked at Mrs. McGurk, and the look of embarrassment on her face made me want to apologize for her husband's outburst. I opened my mouth to speak, but she got there first. "I'm right here, Leroy," she said. Silence. Her pain and humiliation was palatable before she turned and left the room. She hadn't been just shamed in front of her blind, drunk, cigar-puffing husband, but also in front of me, her husband's brand-new assistant. There was a long, sobering stillness before Leroy pivoted his head in my general direction. His sharp and gruff demeanor had changed. He looked troubled, hugely disappointed, but in me. "You should have told me that fat bastard was standing there, kid. You hear me? You hear me?" As I stood there with Leroy continuing to chew me out, I had a feeling that this new job in this new business mightn't be like all the other jobs out there. There was no easy way into the wrestling business. The old-timers reminded me again and again just how lucky I was to be in their world, to know that nearly everyone I was surrounded by got into the wrestling business by being either an amateur wrestler, an outstanding athlete, or related to or knowing someone already in the business. I had ticked none of those boxes. I had no one who would even vouch for me. The chances of being let in were minuscule, and yet there I stood, green as goose shit and scared as hell. It was like I was trying to break into a non-violent mafia, and my schooling started immediately. Not only was I allowed into the business, but I was almost immediately placed slap bang in the center of it because Leroy's lack of sight meant that I was his official note taker at booking meetings where all the most delicate of plans were discussed. I found out that Leroy had lost sight in one eye as a child before a car accident blinded his other eye in 1951. Watts wasn't so sure. "He lost his good eye in a bar fight," he told me. Bill and Leroy couldn't agree on what happened to Leroy's eye or really anything else for that matter. Right from the start, I got a double shot of the Leroy McGurk, Bill Watts philosophies as they routinely butted heads. Their arguments, though, were a masterclass for me to witness. I was frequently exposed to two professors who had different theories on how to make money in the wrestling business. Within a couple of weeks, I saw that McGurk was the figurehead boss who had enough clout to make changes to a card. He was brilliant, when sober, when it came to verbalizing the basics and the psychology of a wrestling match. His theories and base philosophies of good versus evil, building personal issues, keeping a strong value on the territory's titles, and not insulting the audience were amazing lessons to learn. I could see that behind the smoke and liquor breath, Leroy was an extremely smart man. Watts, however, was the real boss, who slowly revealed himself to be a legitimate pro wrestling genius who had great vision for the long-term big picture. I watched him time and time again expertly explain that vision to the broadcasters, wrestlers, referees, and TV directors so that all the cogs in the wheel were turning fluidly. Bill also had a magnificent eye for talent. Even though both Leroy and Cowboy oftentimes mixed like oil and water, observing them both began to cement my own theory on where I might carve out a career for myself in the business, if I were to last. Even though I was a passable athlete, I knew I wasn't ever going to have the physique to be a successful wrestler. The guys I grew up seeing in the magazines, by and large, appeared to be bigger than life in some way or another. Dick the Bruiser, the top star in Indianapolis and one of wrestling's most legendary brawlers, was only 5'9", but he had a 60-inch chest. The world heavyweight champion for most of my formative years was the great Lou Thesz. Thesz, like his junior heavyweight counterpart, Danny Hodge, was a thoroughbred. He was long and lean, with unbelievable physical conditioning and endurance. Cowboy Bill Watts himself was a 6'3", 300-pounder, and one of the strongest men in all of sports. I knew I would never be any of those things, and as enthralled as I was with the business, the idea of in-ring performance just never called to me. So if I wanted to make a go of it, I knew it would have to be behind the scenes. And that's where I was positioned. The way Watts described my initial job with Leroy was, you're going to pick up Mr. McGurk in the morning, and you're going to bring him to the office. You're going to run errands for whatever he needs. Help him out around the office, and then take him home. I quickly learned what Leroy needed first, before everything else, was his daily El Producto Presidente cigars and a pint of whiskey. And every other Tuesday, you'll be responsible for getting him to Shreveport for TV, Watts continued. On those TV days, I was to make sure that Leroy's coat was buttoned and fly was zipped, that he was wearing the right shirt with the right pants, basically making sure he was presentable for the TV cameras, where he would then color commentate the matches. Tulsa to Shreveport was about 330 miles each way, which translated into several hours in Leroy's Cadillac. I always enjoyed those journeys because up to that point, I had only ever seen a few Cadillacs from afar, much less sat in one. En route to Shreveport, the level of conversation depended largely on Leroy's mood and how much whiskey he'd polished off. Some days he had had enough that he'd doze off pretty quickly, which made for a peaceful ride. Other days he'd be angry at one of the boys, one of their wives, or one of his office stooges. Leroy was frequently surrounded by these sycophants, guys who would tell him whatever they thought he wanted to hear just to keep themselves in plum positions within the promotion. Sometimes Leroy was mad at Bill, and I get to hear all about that the whole way to Shreveport for 5 hours. 5 miserable hours. Most often, it was because Bill had booked a card and Leroy, half drunk and with an earful of whispers from the sycophants, would change it. Bill would then change it back. Booking decisions, stooge rage, or inebriated rants were one thing from Leroy, but this day, as we left Tulsa, he took his Cadillac rancor to an entirely different level. Did I tell you what we're going to do when we get to Shreveport tonight? He asked me. Before I could answer, Leroy opened the leather satchel that usually only housed his whiskey and cigars. Except this time, I could see the smokes and the alcohol weren't lying in the bag alone. They were accompanied by a .44 Magnum revolver, the Dirty Harry version. When I saw the gun, I momentarily forgot his question, my answer, where we're going, and most everything else. He placed the revolver on the dashboard and calmly lit a cigar. What we're going to do in Shreveport tonight is kill Ted DiBiase, he said. Yeah, my heart thumping in my chest. Yeah, he replied, as cool as ice. I peeked over and saw Leroy was indeed in the killing mood. Why are we going to do that? I asked. Leroy seemed surprised at my response. Haven't you heard he's dating my daughter? DiBiase was a newcomer, the stepson of veteran wrestler Iron Mike DiBiase and the son of wrestler Helen Hild. The youngster was defying Leroy's number one in-house rule. No wrestler was to date his lovely young daughter. No matter the circumstances, or that Ted and his daughter were a similar age, Leroy wanted his offspring completely separated from the business that he immersed himself in. Let's go, he said. I put my hand on the key of the ignition, but couldn't bring myself to turn it. How are you going to kill him? I asked. I might not have been a genius, but even I could figure out how limited a blind assassin might be. And also, that same blind assassin kept using the phrase, we, as in, we are going to kill Ted DiBiase tonight. Leroy, nursing his bottle of whiskey, laid out the master plan. We check into the Alamo Plaza, as usual, when we get to Shreveport. You get me to my room, set me in a chair facing the front door, leave the door cracked open a bit. I nodded, even though he couldn't see me. He continued, "Then you point my gun hand, point it at the right direction, and tell DiBiase that I want to see him. You tell him it's because I have a great idea for him." The way Leroy mapped it out, DiBiase would knock on Leroy's door, and he'd announce himself in his distinctively deep voice. Leroy would start shooting. He'd unload the .44 chamber and hope the law of averages would put a bullet into the rookie who dared woo his daughter. "You understand?" Leroy asked. "Got it," I replied. I tried to console myself a little with the fact that Ted would at least meet his maker in the nice Alamo Plaza, as there were two in Shreveport, sitting side by side. One was a nice hotel where Leroy was going to commit murder at $25 a night, and the other was where I was staying, a $10 a night, no-frills dump. As we silently continued our drive to Shreveport, I kept watching at the revolver rattling freely on the dashboard. Leroy was drinking more and more and fogging up the car with his cigars. I was typically a very careful, attentive driver, but couldn't help but notice the barrel of the gun slowly vibrating its way around to me. The slow roulette of the business end of the Magnum, inching around in my direction, kept me from being fully focused on the road or my boss. Leroy always wore Jaymar Sansevieria slacks, double-knit polyester pants with an elastic waistband and a size bigger than he needed for comfort. This meant there was a lot of extra material to the pants. Usually, I would tell him when his cigar ash was getting long enough for him to flick into his old coffee can, but I was so fixated on the gun pointing at me and my impending accompaniment in a murder that I didn't realize that the ash from Leroy's cigar was getting longer each mile we drove. Inevitably, the hot, long ash fell squarely into Leroy's double-knit slacks, where it smoldered, unnoticed by us both, until it burned right through his polyester, settling neatly into his old man crotch. "What the fuck?" Leroy screamed as he leaped suddenly from his seat. His unexpected shriek startled me into thinking the gun had gone off, and I swerved the big Cadillac and nearly lost control as Leroy, in his pain and panic, wailed away on me and roared for me to do something. The car weaved all over the two-lane road as the untethered Magnum slid from one end of the dashboard to the other as my boss rapidly slapped his own crotch like a drum solo. I slid the car to a stop, hopped out, and ran around the passenger side and opened Leroy's door. The other cars in the road were hurtling past dangerously close as I got down on my knees to help my shrieking boss. "Do something," he roared. "For the love of God!" I could see exactly where the smoke was coming from, and I wasn't totally happy about going in after it. "My balls, Jim! They're burning!" I began to lightly blow at first, like they were birthday candles. It made no difference. "Did you just try to blow out?" "No," I lied. Leroy, sick of waiting for action, thrust his pelvic bone into the air, and it was in that moment that I prayed a state trooper wouldn't pull over to see what was going on. Here I was, young and green, on the side of the road, with my Oklahoman face in the testicle region of a blind older gentleman who was totally agitated, confused, and inebriated. But I knew what I had to do. I did what any decent human being would do in that situation. I slapped my boss repeatedly in the balls. "Is it working?" I shouted. I don't know why. He was blind, not deaf. I picked up the pace and widened out my hand to cover a larger distance. I was into it now, totally on board with the nut touching. Leroy was thrusting and I was slapping. Between us both, we managed to snuff out the source of the scorching without any permanent scar tissue. There was silence between us, unknowing. I got back in the car, composed myself, and took the opportunity to place Leroy's wild and free Magnum back into his leather satchel. I said, "Everything okay down?" "Yep," he said. It was that kind of yep that meant shut up and drive. So I did. I motored for a few quiet miles before I stopped at a service station to look for a phone. The burning crotch situation may have been dealt with, but the DiBiase situation was still very much on the table. I didn't know what to do, so I used the public phone booth and called the office, Collect. Bill had established that the code name for collect calls to the office was Gene Kaninsky, a former NWA heavyweight champion. Watts told me if the office got a collect call with that name attached, they knew that it was a serious call that needed addressing. This also helped the office save money, as ringing Gene Kaninsky back was cheaper than taking the charge of a collect call. The office would tell the operator, "There's no one here that can authorize taking a collect call, but if you'll give us a number, we'll have someone call back." Another few dollars saved. I called, gave the Kaninsky name, and waited for the operator to tell me they would call back. Even though Cowboy was wrestling on TV the next evening, he was still in the office because he was going to fly his plane to Shreveport, which meant he'd get there in a fraction of the time it took for us to drive there. The service station payphone rang after a couple of minutes with Bill on the line. "Well, your partner and I are on our way to Shreveport to kill Ted DiBiase," I said. "What?" "Yep, Leroy's drunk. He's got a .44 Magnum, and he's worked out how to kill Ted and to make me an accomplice." Bill started laughing. I didn't think it was funny at all, but Bill was just howling. What a team of hitmen we were. A sightless, drunken senior citizen with smoldering slacks and his greenhorn assistant who had just spent the last 2 minutes punching Mr. McGurk in the balls. Finally, after a few seconds, Bill settled down enough to say, "Okay, let me think." "All right, Jim. He's got to be close to passing out from the whiskey, so just get him to the hotel, get him into bed. I'll be down there by the time you guys get there, and I'll take him off your hands." My call to Bill confirmed to him that I was indeed doing what I was mostly hired to do, babysit Leroy McGurk. I didn't even realize that was basically my job at the beginning, but more importantly, neither did Leroy. Chapter 9, Refereeing, 1974. Bill pegged the cost of my services to the company at a hefty price tag of $125 a week. As time passed, he could see I had a good grasp of the basics and took notice of how nothing they said in their meetings ever got out through me. "I can rely on your discretion," he said, which was in dangerously short supply in the wrestling business. Leo Voss, a referee who had been a journeyman wrestler in the 1940s and 50s, took me under his wing because he could see that integrity in me too. Leo spent around 5 years at the beginning of his career as a wrestler, but the following 30 years as a referee, booker, and valued member of the office. His career was cut short when he got hit in the head by a glass bottle by a fan in Louisiana. In less than a month, cataracts were forming on his eyes, and Leo's vision and mobility began to rapidly decline. But he stayed around the office with not much to do. I, for one, was happy that such experience and wisdom was on tap. "If Leroy or Bill find out that you've told anyone anything from those meetings, they will fire you," Leo warned me. "You know that all the boys know you're in these meetings. They're going to do anything they can. They'll ply you with liquor. They'll try to get you laid. They'll buy you meals. Whatever they think it will take to entice you to reveal booking secrets. And also know that most of them are con men. Lousy, no-good bastards. So you don't want to tell them nothing. Don't try to make up a story. Just tell them you don't know anything about what they're asking. Or you're not allowed to say anything." Leo's advice was very good because before long, it seemed like half the wrestlers in the company had attempted to ingratiate themselves with me so that I would spill the state secrets to them. They wanted any little nugget of booking information that they could use to manipulate themselves into better positions. I never said a word. Leo himself tried to get information from me. And if he saw for a second that I was about to crack, he would say, "You can't trust me either, kid." Keeping Cowboy's confidence was the foundation to make sure I survived within the promotion. Bill, in particular, could see I wasn't in the company to politic my way into being a manager or wrestler. I was genuinely happy to do whatever the company needed me to do. The only way Cowboy could convince Leroy to lay out the exorbitant sum to pay me was by assuring him that I would be working three jobs for that one paycheck. As always, by hiring me, Bill was moving his chess pieces around the board a couple of moves at a time. I wouldn't just be Leroy's assistant. I would also help out in the office all week during the day, and then at night, I would work as a referee. The officials were all fine referees, but they all were getting older, and Bill wanted a referee with a little bit more mobility, one who could get more mixed up in the physicality when needed. He was selling wrestling matches as if they were a shoot or legitimate contest. This called for physically capable-looking officials in order to convince the audience that you could keep up with the pace of the contest and not make bad calls caused by getting caught out of position. In reality, the true skill was to place yourself out of position without it looking like you meant to, so that the heel or the bad guy wrestler could cheat without penalty. This would drive the audience nuts, as the dastardly deed would go unpunished. Even though he wanted changes, Bill didn't rush me into the ring. I only started refereeing a few months after they hired me. He ensured I was being indoctrinated properly by first enrolling me in the Cowboy Bill Watts School of Promotional Psychology. Our campus was whatever rental car we were using as it went from market to market through Louisiana. Bill had me drive while he spent mile after mile talking with me, educating me, and getting me ready for my upcoming role as referee. Approach every match with the same decorum and seriousness that you use in those football games you officiate, he said. The wrestlers aren't going to treat you any differently than those players. They're not going to abuse you, and they're not going to make a mockery of you because you represent the integrity of this organization. This approach also meant the wrestlers had to be alert. If a heel was too lazy to hide an illegal hold, such as a choke, I would order them to break the hold, even if that conflicted with what the heel was planning. The great heels were the ones who could maneuver me into a position where I honestly couldn't lay eyes on their rule-breaking acts. Our interest lies in the fans hating our bad guys, so they finally pay to see our heroes beat them, Watts continued. And they set themselves out as bad guys at times by doing chicken shit moves. And what gets a crowd hotter than someone cheating? When they don't get caught cheating, and they lie or deny when asked. Watts always wanted to maintain credibility with our fans and get across our key points as effectively as possible in every aspect of the promotion. My first match as referee was a young Mike George versus Memphis veteran Henry Tretch Phillips. Before the match, one of Bill's office guys said to me, "Hey, kid, you know you're doing a 10-minute Broadway." Clueless, I said, "Okay." I thought it was some sort of reference to New York, as if something was going to happen in the match that would lend itself to a big stage show, but I wasn't so sure, so I sought out Leo Boss again, who had a world of experience. "What's a Broadway mean?" I asked him. Leo was more than happy to answer. As a matter of fact, I think he was as happy to have me around as I was having him around. I was the eager young kid looking to learn, and he was the old soldier who loved passing on his considerable knowledge. "A Broadway is when a match goes to a time limit draw," Leo answered. Bill overheard our conversation and asked Leo to get me ready. "Take the kid and explain how this works," Bill said. To everyone else who was smart to the business and had their own work to do, having an old referee hang around the office was a bit of a nuisance. To me, it was another opportunity to learn everything I could, in this instance, about refereeing. Referee like it's a shoot, like a real contest, Leo said. Watch for rule violations and make sure you're in position to see both shoulders during a pin attempt. If you see an illegal move or hold, admonish the heel before starting your five count to force the break. If the heel doesn't stop whatever illegal activity he's doing before you reach the count of five, disqualify him. If he's stupid enough to get caught and defy your count, stop the contest, then let Bill deal with him when he gets to the back after the match. Remember, see what you call and call what you see, like real life. My first match went okay. I was out of position in places and nervous as hell. I knew I had a lot more to learn. I went from Leo to Bill to anyone else I could ask for more advice. I wanted to learn more and more about the nuances of the business. I would ask the old-timers, the wrestlers, and even some legends as well. Show me how to count. Harley Race and Dory Funk Jr. were in the midst of their pre-match warm-ups. Dory was off in the corner doing push-ups, and Harley was sitting on a bench smoking a Marlboro. Race and Funk were to go a one-hour Broadway, and this time I didn't need to ask what it meant. Show me how you count, Harley said again. I got down on my knees and slapped my hand to the floor three times with even intervals, about a second each. Harley took a drag and asked, and you count that way every time? Yes, sir. He seemed pleased by my answer. Just make sure you count at the same cadence every time. Yes, sir. Anything else? Yes. If you see me cheat, make me break, Harley said. If you don't see it, then don't let the audience officiate for you. Remember, they're going to see me cheat because my goal is only to keep you from seeing me, not them. The beauty of that was, when I finally did catch him, and I was under no illusion that I only caught him when he was ready for me to catch him, he'd mumble, come on, now give it to me, give it to me. I'd start pointing my finger at him and gesturing dramatically, and Harley sold it like he was both furious with me and afraid of the sanctions I could bring down on him. In the story we were telling, if Harley pushed me too far and I disqualified him, then he would lose the match and the winner's end of the purse. Here he was, maybe the best wrestler in the world and one of the greatest of all time, and he was selling for a 20-something green-as-grass kid because he respected the business and the value of the referee in the match process. Harley knew how to use the position of referee to accentuate the match, to give it more flavor. Others who were not so generous tried to use the referee to take from the match. Jerry the Duke Miller was a veteran villain out of Moline, Illinois. He was a skilled in-ring talent, but was an old-school carny sort of wrestler who was always looking for the shortcut in life. He was known in the business as a carpenter, someone with the skill to build another wrestler into a main event player. He was also a little bit of a freak with the ladies, as he carried a wide assortment of vibrators and dildos with him in his wrestling bag. These toys were so important to the Duke that they had their own bag, within his gear bag, a sovereign state of sex toys, if you will. He was also a hairdresser, not a barber, but a stylist. Jerry knew most everything there was to know about conditioners and coloring. He was quite possibly the first man in all of wrestling to have a mullet. He was Mr. Ground Zero of the business in the front and the party in the back haircut. And when he wanted to wrestle, he was actually very good. But when he didn't, he was savvy enough to take the shortcuts that made others look bad, i.e. me. I was working my count just like Leo taught me, and the Duke was walking around outside the ring. I knew this was nothing unusual, as skilled heels used as much of the 20 count as they could for the crowd. It was their job to use that time to stall and mouth off at the fans. It was my job to count. So that's what I did, with conviction and authority. As I made my way into the teens, I could see that Jerry wasn't getting any closer to the ring. 18. 19. 19. 19? He was nowhere near getting back into the ring to break my count and continue the match to its planned finish. The Duke knew exactly what he was doing, just like Leo Voss had told me, just like Bill Watts drilled into me. A referee stands and falls on his ability to command a match. His authority is the key to heels cheating and good guys persevering. By Jerry staying outside and me not counting him out, I looked at fault. I looked weak. All I could think to do was stall myself, look around the ring like something else had distracted me. Luckily for me, the other person in the match knew exactly what to do. Danny Hodge, a legit amateur wrestling legend and childhood hero of mine, was about to give me some much-needed assistance. Hodge could see the heat from the crowd was going to the wrong guy. It was going to me, the ref. Danny was a legit shooter, a total badass, who knew the wrestling business inside and out. He didn't need to see any more of Jerry's antics to know that the audience was getting the wrong kind of pissed. It was taught in wrestling that you wanted the crowd to be angry enough at the bad guy to want to buy tickets to see him get his ass kicked the next time. Referees don't sell tickets, and Danny wasn't going to work a multiple-week program in the ring with me, thank God. So the audience turning on me wasn't going to sell one single ticket for Danny's next encounter with Jerry Miller. The Duke was now potentially taking money from Danny Hodge's future payoffs, and that just wasn't going to happen. "Stand aside, Tiger," Hodge said as he passed through the ropes. He caught up to Jerry and manhandled him back into the ring. The Duke tried to put up some resistance, but I quickly learned when Hodge wanted a man to acquiesce, there wasn't much that man could do but acquiesce. I had personally seen Hodge break pliers and turn whole apples into pulp with his legendary grip strength, so I could only imagine what he could do to a man's bones and muscle tissue. Jerry begged off for real, but Hodge wanted to make sure that there would be no further nonsense. Hodge took him to the canvas and applied a legitimate double wrist lock to subdue any remaining resistance from Jerry. "I quit," he shouted. "Danny, I quit." When Danny didn't let up, Jerry turned to me. "I quit, referee. Call the match." I looked for my cue from Danny, who simply instructed me to ignore the Duke's call, because that wasn't the planned finish either. After squeezing all the friskiness out of his opponent, Danny whispered, "Let's go home," which was wrestling speak for ending the match. Jerry nodded furiously in agreement. "Yes, go home, go home." And that's just what we did. Danny released his hold, and Jerry moved into position to finish the match. He miraculously remembered just where he had to be and just what the finish of the match was. Hodge won. "Don't ever jack around on my watch again," Danny said to Jerry back in the locker room. The Duke nodded. Hodge wasn't loud or aggressive because he never needed to be. He was all matter of fact, all business. "Don't ever do anything that could mess with my money again either," Danny continued. Jerry nodded again. Danny put his hand on my shoulder and said in Jerry's direction, "And don't ever let me see you middling the referee again either. There's no money in that." Danny put his hand out to seal their understanding with a handshake. He took Jerry at his word and didn't need or want the rest of the locker room to hear about it. "You're right. I'm sorry." And with that, Jerry the Duke Miller made the mistake of shaking Danny's hand. Miller got the point, the nuances, the gist, the flavor, the story, the picture, and the exclamation point. I handed the Duke his bag of sex toys, and he left, gingerly, for the next town while massaging his aching hand. In that moment, I saw in Danny Hodge just how I wanted to navigate this crazy business I found myself in. My handshake mightn't have the same power attached to it, but I wanted it to mean something. Chapter 10, Still Learning, 1975. I was about a year into my summer job in the wrestling business, and having bedded down my position in the company somewhat, I began to look for more ways to make a few extra dollars. At $125 a week, the incentive was there to look into other money-making opportunities in other areas of the business. I began hauling the ring. I then agreed to haul the ring and set it up for an extra $50 a night. I quickly moved from hauling the ring to hauling the boys. There was a standing deal with the veteran wrestlers in which they would pay young guys 2 cents a mile to drive them to and from the shows. A full tank of gas was about $5. A hotel room was about $8. And a seasoned wrestler knew the location of every $2.99 all-you-can-eat buffet in town. By the end of the week, I'd rack up an extra $30 per wrestler just running the 1,500 miles per week that constituted the low end of the territory. That was a pretty good little bonus for being a wheel man. Apart from the money, every car trip was a potential learning experience, as the conversation would always drift into the wrestling business. Of course, being surrounded by some of the best in the business, wrestling wasn't all that I learned about as I drove. I learned how to carry myself around champions and con men. I learned about life. And most importantly, for my survival, I learned how to roll the world's best joints while steering the car with my knees. I knew if I wanted to make myself indispensable to the veterans, I had to drive well and roll even better. They saw nothing wrong with me driving with no hands, but they never wanted me stoned while driving them, so I always got passed over. Not that it ever really mattered, as I got a contact high more often than not. Rolling joints added another string to my bow, another reason to keep me around, and I rolled enough bones to really get damn great at it. Of course, hauling such a collection of persons in my car meant that it damn near needed fumigating after a few days of travel. We didn't run shows on Sundays, but I still didn't get my biblically prescribed day of rest. Sunday was my day to clean out the car and try to make it smell like new again, instead of a sewage treatment plant. Between the farts, the food wrappers, the marijuana smoke, and the spilt booze, it smelled like the underscrubbed armpit of a long-dead farm animal. My car saw quite a difference between the smoky, raucous nights with the wrestlers and the calm Sunday mornings with my family. I was very much aware that I was a farm boy, living both sides of one life. Despite his lingering dislike for me and people in general, Tretch Phillips was one of my frequent passengers. His antipathy toward me didn't stop Tretch from jumping into my car at the end of a show. He always insisted we stop and get beer. And I don't mean every now and then. I mean he needed a six-pack after every single show. Not that drinking between towns was unusual. It's just that others ask. Tretch demanded. He also refused to pay me for the trip most times. He'd tell me that he was Leroy's guy, and Leroy said he didn't need to pay. No matter the length of the journey, he seemed comfortable sitting in the awkwardness between us, drinking, scowling, and smoking his cheap cigars. The more he traveled with me, the greater the tension grew between us. "Pull over," he said, as we left another town. "We're in the middle of nowhere." "Where?" I asked. "Don't care. I need something to drink." Tretch crushed his empty beer container and dropped it in the floor of my car. I couldn't take it anymore. Something to drink? I asked. He never even looked up at me to answer, now. So I did hurry to the nearest Dairy Queen. What the hell are we doing here? Well, Tretch, I said you wanted something to drink. He looked at me all confused. Beer, goddammit. Wrestlers drink beer, he growled. Wrestlers don't drink milkshakes. That's funny, I said, because Denny Hodge drinks a milkshake just about every trip we go on. Tretch opened his mouth to speak, but he knew better than to say anything bad about Hodge. Even though I was a greenhorn and couldn't really call him on his bullshit, he didn't dare talk smack about Danny Hodge. Chocolate shake, I asked as I got out the car. As I walked away, I could hear him cursing me. Finishing out the last 50 miles of that trip, slurping as long and as loud as I could on my shake while I watched Tretch seethe in the back seat. That was the last time he rode with me. Guess I won the competition after all. I started to get more selective about who I would drive around with. Danny Hodge and Jim Skandar Akbar Weba were my absolute favorite passengers. Behind the scenes, they were great friends, and driving them around was always fun. Danny didn't smoke and hardly ever drank, aside from the very occasional Mai Tai or some other fruit drink, as Danny's only vice was that he had a big sweet tooth. Akbar would occasionally smoke a cigar, but like Danny, he didn't need to stop and get beer after a show as he wasn't a big drinker. As much as I enjoyed and respected Akbar, it was Hodge who was my wrestling hero. I can still remember watching him wrestle on my TV during the summer of 1964 when the unthinkable happened. Hodge lost the World Junior Heavyweight Championship to the villainous Hiro Matsuda. When I met him years later, of course, the villainous Matsuda turned out to be one of the nicest men in the business. But I was devastated as a kid when he beat Hodge, the Oklahoma Hero. Hodge was so admired and so respected where I came from that he was always known as champ, even when he wasn't holding a title. I was going to show my hero that I was as good at my job as he was at his. I was going to take him from town to town, set up the ring, and referee all his matches, and he wouldn't have to worry about a thing. After a few months of that schedule, I began to feel like I might have overthought my position. Sleep, as it happens, is important to the human condition, and I wasn't getting much. You got to keep your eyes open, Hodge told me as we each downed our post-match milkshake. People in this business like to cheat, even when there's no reason, and I'm talking inside and outside the ring. I listened. I nodded, but he knew I really didn't know what he meant yet. I was only a couple of years in the business, but Danny had a soft spot for me and knew it was better for me to learn that important lesson from him rather than someone else. He finished his shake and signaled for us to hit the road again. You want me to drive, Tiger? He asked. He could see my eyes were heavy after another long day working in the office, then hauling and setting up the ring for the show, refereeing the matches, tearing down the ring, and driving to the next town. No, Danny, it's fine, I said. I do this all the time. I knew by the way he looked at me that he wasn't sure. I was determined, but 5 minutes into the drive and my eyes were already closing. Danny could see it, and I knew he could see it, but damn it if I was going to look like less of a man in front of the champ. You okay? He asked again, a little more concerned this time. Yes, sir, I answered, way too loudly and way too enthusiastically. Hodge chimed in again. Tiger, you need to get some sleep. You've had a long day, and I can drive for a while. As much as I wanted to, I couldn't resist the offer of sleep any longer. Every day was a long day for someone in my low-level position. So the thought of a quick snooze between towns was a hard proposal to turn down. We pulled over and swapped places. Sorry, I said. Don't worry about it. I laid my seat back a bit, and finally, giving my eyes permission to close, was damn near heavenly. I quickly fell asleep, feeling an overwhelming sense of contentment. and then awoke again with an overwhelming sense of terror. "Danny!" I shouted as I saw Hodge was